Frickel to provide an introduction to our series and our speakers. Cindy?
Thank you, Jean. Welcome, everyone. I just want to let you know that today's webinar presentations are based on talks that were given at the most recent Federal Remediation Technologies Roundtable General Meeting. The FRTR is a collaborative effort by federal agencies that are involved in hazardous waste site cleanup. So today's speakers represent just a few of FRTR's member agencies. You can learn more about FRTR's ongoing work and upcoming meetings at FRTR.gov. So our first speaker today is going to be Claire Tiedemann. Claire is a research hydrologist with the USGS, and her research is focused on developing and applying methods for characterization and modeling groundwater flow and chemical transport in fractured rock. So if you'll give me just a moment here, I'm going to hand things over to Claire. Okay. All right, Claire, I can hear you. And you should be able to move the slides in just a moment. All right, Claire, take it away.
Okay. Thank you very much, Cindy and Jean. I'm going to be talking about developing conceptual site models, or CSMs, of contaminated fractured rocks to support in-situ remediation. And I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors at the USGS and at Boise State University. And I'd also like to acknowledge support for this work from the USGS and also from CERDIP, the Navy, and the EPA. Okay, so a roadmap of my talk is shown here. I'll start with a motivation for the work, then introduce the field site, and then we'll come to the two main parts of my talk, which are on two studies that we conducted at the field site, one on developing a CSM to inform bioremediation, and the second using hydraulic tomography to develop a CSM for source zone remediation. And I'll end with a few final thoughts. So turning to the motivation, as I think most of you know, in-situ remediation typically involves injection of amendments to stimulate contaminant degradation and transformation processes. So it's the distribution of the subsurface hydraulic properties that controls groundwater fluxes and therefore controls the spread of these amendments during and after injection. So therefore, understanding the hydrogeology of the subsurface is really critical for designing injection strategies that spread these amendments to where we want them to go, which is to locations of contamination in the fractures and in the rock matrix. Now, a word about the matrix. These in-situ amendments might not actually enter the rock matrix because of poor size limitations, but enhanced degradation in the fractures adjacent to the matrix leads to enhanced back diffusion out of the matrix. So getting the amendments to fractures adjacent to the matrix is important. So our field site is the former Naval Air Warfare Center, or NAWC site, in West Trenton, New Jersey. And this was the focus site for USGS research on contaminant processes in fractured rocks for about 13 years. The site is underlain by dipping fractured sedimentary rocks, and groundwater is highly contaminated with TCE and its biodegradation products. The geology is the Lacotong Formation of the Newark Basin, which, let me get the pointer here, which consists of these competent dipping mudstone beds overlain by weathered rocks and saprolite. So the dominant groundwater flow paths in this system are along bedding plane parting fractures, but crossbed fractures that connect different of the bedding units are also very important to groundwater flow and contaminant transport, as you'll see in the studies that I'm going to show. Here's what the rocks look like. In core here, the weathered rocks are very broken up. And then the competent rocks look like this. There are three rock types. We have laminated, fissile, and mudstone beds. The fissile mudstones tend to be the most fractured in the subsurface. Here's the rocks in outcrop and in road cut. We have extremely high concentrations of TCE and DCE at the site, which are orders of magnitude above US EPA standards, the MCLs or maximum contaminant levels. Here's an example of that showing concentrations at several depths in wells at the site, and you can see how the concentrations are in the thousands at all depths. The concentration is also extremely persistent. We have high contaminant concentrations despite a pump and treat system operating at the site for over 20 years. And that's illustrated here, where this is concentrations in one of the pumping wells, where over the 20 years of pumping, the concentrations still at the current or near the current time are orders of magnitude above the EPA MCL for TCE. And the reason for that, of course, is that in fractured rocks, when we have decades of contamination that has occurred, the contaminants diffuse into the rock matrix and migrate into low permeability fractures. And so when we then start to pump, these contaminants have to slowly back diffuse out of the matrix, and they serve as a secondary source in the subsurface that continues to feed the fractures and causes continued contamination of the fractures. Okay, I'll turn to the first of the two studies I'm going to talk about. This involves development and evolution of a conceptual site model to inform bioremediation. The bioremediation at the site was conducted in the area shown here. And here's a cross-section through that area. There are four wells involved. 36BR is the well for injection of amendments. The amendments are injected into 36, it's open interval, and then they migrate towards the pumping well, 15BR, which is one of the pump and treat wells at the site. And we installed these two wells in between that are monitor wells, 73BR and 71BR. I'll be referring back to these wells numerous times as I discuss this study. So the bioremediation involved injecting electron donor and microbes, which are aimed at stimulating the population of the natural microbial population. Microbes, a certain part of the population, is able to degrade TCE to DCE to vinyl chloride and finally to non-toxic ethane. And that's the process that we're trying to stimulate in this area between the injection and the pumped well by injecting these amendments. So there are several questions at the outset of our study that we had that relate to the hydrogeology. What are the transport paths between our injection and our pumped well? Notably, the injection well is open to different mudstone beds than the pumped well is open to. So somehow the amendments to get to the pumped well have to move not along the bedding plane parting fractures, but along some crossbed fractures somewhere to enable their transport to this other mudstone bed. Another question related to the hydrogeology, how much amendment volume should we inject? Should the pumping rate at the extraction well remain at its normal rate that is part of the pump and treat system, or will that too rapidly sweep out the amendments out of the subsurface? And where along this transect should we expect treatment? We conducted several investigations to answer these questions, and those included hydraulic and tracer testing and flow and transport modeling. So I'll first turn to the field characterization activities that we conducted. Single hole hydraulic testing to obtain transmissivity estimates or transmissivity profiles along the boreholes showed that we generally had lower hydraulic conductivity or transmissivity in the down dip portion of this transect and higher hydraulic conductivity up dip. Cross hole aquifer testing was conducted by turning off the pump in this pumping well and monitoring water level rises at all packed off intervals of the wells along this section. And that work showed that the most prominent water level responses occurred in the intervals highlighted here in red. This suggested that the crossbed fractures that we were interested in identifying are likely in the region between these two monitor wells. And we conducted a cross-hole tracer test by injecting a bromide solution into this well and monitoring its breakthrough at the pumping well. So this tracer really acted like a surrogate for the amendments that we intended to inject, which we also were planning to inject in this well and monitor throughout this section. So that tracer test, the breakthrough curve at the pumped well is shown here in red. And the conclusions from this testing were that, first of all, there was a huge dilution at the pumped well. The peak concentration of this breakthrough curve is 0.06 milligrams per liter, which is orders of magnitude smaller than the 3,700 milligrams per liter that was injected to initiate the tracer test. So what that means is that only a small amount of the pumped water in this well is actually coming from this region down dip along this transect, and the vast majority of the pumped water is coming from other regions. This testing also showed that a very large percentage of the bromide mass was still in the aquifer after this 5-month monitoring period. That's shown by the blue curve, which indicates that only 17% of the bromide injected was recovered. So at the 6-month period following injection, we sampled all intervals along this transect and found that most of the mass has been retained in the down dip portion of this section, and that's consistent with our single hole transmissivity results that showed that we generally have lower K in this down dip section and higher K in the up dip section. So the lower K rocks and fractures here are strongly retaining the tracer, and using the tracer as a surrogate for the amendments to be injected, that indicates we're likely to have strong retention of the amendments in this portion of the section as well. Another important component of developing the hydrogeologic conceptual site model is conducting flow and transport modeling in addition to the field characterization. The field characterization provides us with qualitative information about flow and transport, but it doesn't provide information about the distribution and the magnitude of groundwater fluxes. And these fluxes are very important because they are what control our amendment transport. And flow modeling can provide these fluxes. And then subsequent transport modeling uses these fluxes from the flow modeling to simulate the spatial and time-varying tracer distribution, which informs the expected advective transport of the amendments, again, using the tracer as a surrogate for the amendments. So I want to spend a little time discussing the hydraulic conductivity representation in the model, because it's really key to the modeling results. And that distribution is informed by the geologic and hydraulic and tracer testing field characterization. So there are three important model layers involved in simulating the fluxes and then the transport from the injection well to the pumping well. The lower model layer, shown here in plan view and here along the section, represents the bed that we're injecting the tracer into. Now that bed generally has high K at the site scale, but our hydrogeologic investigation showed that there is low K around the injection well and towards the first monitor well, 73BR. So we represent that in the model. The middle model layer is generally low K at the site, but we found that there are likely to be important crossbed fractures in the area between the two monitor wells. And so that is explicitly represented in this model. And then finally, the upper model layer generally has low K at the site scale, but has high K in the region where 15BR pumps from it. So the groundwater fluxes simulated by the calibrated model show that the vast majority, if we look at the fluxes coming into this crossbed fracture from this lower model layer, the vast majority of that flux is coming from the high K portion of this mudstone bed, from areas other than along our transect where we're going to do the bioremediation. And only a small portion of the flux is entering the crossbed fracture from this area. So we use those fluxes to simulate the bromide tracer test. And that simulation shows that after we inject, shortly after we inject, the tracer has moved out into the low K zone surrounding the injection well. After 10 hours, it hasn't moved much beyond that. And after 100 hours, it has moved out of this low K zone through the crossbed fracture and to the next down gradient monitor well and the pumping well. So looking a little more closely at that, we conclude that because of the retention in the low K zone here and the dilution that's occurring in this crossbed fracture, the simulation shows that tracer concentrations are much lower down gradient of this crossbed fracture compared to in the low K zone up gradient of that fracture. So we conclude from this that in terms of expectations for our bioremediation, don't expect high amendment concentrations down gradient of this crossbed fracture at 71BR or 15BR. So we obtained answers from our hydrogeologic and modeling investigation to the questions we had at the outset. How much volume to inject? We need to inject enough to spread the amendments widely over this low K zone. Pumping rate at the extraction well? No need to reduce the rate. We're not going to sweep large quantities of the amendments out at the pumping well because of this strong retention. Where to expect treatment? In the low K zone, because of dilution, we're not going to expect substantial treatment down gradient of that. So we initiated our bioremediation in October of 2008 by injecting amendments which consisted of emulsified soybean oil and a microbial consortia containing complete TCE dechlorinators. And what happened? If we look at that first downgradient well that's located in the low K zone, this shows concentrations of VOCs over 5 years in time, where this black line represents when we injected the amendments. So the blue line is TCE. TCE was quickly degraded at this well, but dichloroethane was produced and remained high throughout this five-year monitoring period. Rates of degradation to vinyl chloride and to non-toxic ethene are moderate. So we significantly remediated TCE, but we basically created a DCE problem. What happened at the next downgradient well, downgradient of that crossbed fracture? There we see a muted version of what we saw over here, where we've got some degradation of TCE, some production of DCE, again remaining high, and a small amount of vinyl chloride and ethene production. So generally, the difference here compared to here is consistent with our expectations of less treatment at this location. But if we look at the well that's in that low K zone, let's look at expectations versus reality. We expected more complete treatment of the VOCs there in that we injected amendments into this zone. We know they were spread out into this zone, and we know they included microbes capable of complete degradation of TCE to ethene. However, clearly we've got incomplete degradation of DCE and vinyl chloride. So let's look at the cause of this. The high DCE production rate is, well, because we know that the bioremediation has rapidly degraded TCE in the fractures producing DCE, but also that reduced TCE in the fractures increases the back diffusion of TCE out of the matrix and pours more TCE into the fractures, which then also rapidly degrades to DCE. So we've got this sustained TCE in the fractures and sustained production of DCE, but it is not degrading. And why is that? My microbiologist colleagues at the USGS have tried to or have investigated that question. And their work shows that partial dechlorinators, microbes that are only able to dechlorinate TCE to DCE and not further along the pathway, those partial dechlorinators and other microbes are dominating the post-injection population of microbes rather than the microbes capable of complete transformation. And their analyses suggest that the reason for this is because of competition effects. The partial and other microbes are outcompeting the full dechlorinators for the available electron donor. And then toxicity effects also appear to be suppressing the population of the full dechlorinators. So to summarize this lessons learned from this bioremediation experiment, we found that the hydrogeologic characterization modeling are key components of developing the CSM for designing bioremediation. But also additional components of the CSM for designing bioremediation and setting expectations include characterizing biogeochemical processes that are going to affect the evolution of the microbial community following amendment injection, and consideration of the effects of the large contaminant mass in the rock matrix on biodegradation processes post-injection. Okay, I will now turn to the second part of the talk, the second study at the site, which involves using hydraulic tomography to develop a high-resolution CSM in support of source zone remediation. And my co-author on this work is Warren Barish from Boise State University. Okay, hydraulic tomography is a method of estimating high-resolution hydraulic conductivity, or K, using drawdown data from multiple pumping tests. The aquifer volume that we're typically able to apply hydraulic tomography to is on the order of 10 to 20 meters laterally and vertically. And by high resolution here, I mean hydraulic conductivity variations at a scale of 1 meter. So what is the value of obtaining a high resolution estimate of hydraulic conductivity to the problem of in-situ remediation? So in the study I just showed, the hydraulic conductivity was characterized at a relatively low resolution. The data and the modeling supported estimating K in a zonation fashion, if you recall from how we represented K in the model. And this enabled simulating important flux heterogeneities over this 40-meter transect between the injection and pumped wells. Estimation of a higher resolution K distribution supports understanding flow and transport at smaller scales, and thus more targeted delivery of remediation amendments. For example, if we performed hydraulic conductivity just in here, we might be able to design a remediation that targets just the highest concentrations in this sort of subvolume along this transect. So the field application occurred in an existing well field at the site. This well field is circular in dimension. The wells are, the circle is 9 meters across, so we're looking at a very small scale here with a seventh well in the center. The boreholes are open to 15 meters of open hole, open to the dipping mudstones. Acoustic televiewer logs identify the fractures intersecting the boreholes. These acoustic televiewer logs are shown here for three of the boreholes. And of note is that there is a highly fractured zone evident in most of the boreholes that is at the location of this fissile mudstone. It's the same fissile mudstone I discussed in the first part of the talk that's known to have very high hydraulic conductivity at the site scale. The field testing for hydraulic tomography involves conducting multiple cross-hole hydraulic tests in discrete well intervals. These well intervals are created through the use of packers, and monitoring drawdown in all intervals during each of the cross-hole tests, which gives us a dense 3D observation network because we have packed off intervals over all the wells in this volume. So to illustrate that schematically, for example, we conduct a test in the center, in this interval of the center well, monitor everywhere, conduct another test, monitor everywhere, and so on. So all told, over the course of two field seasons, we conducted 47 hydraulic tests in this well field and monitored at 30 to 40 observation intervals during each test, which gave us a total of 1,500 drawdown curves, which as you can imagine, a tremendous amount of information about the hydraulic conductivity in this volume is encapsulated in the collective set of drawdown curves. To give you a little bit a taste of the type of heterogeneity that we see in conducting hydraulic tests in this well field, I'm going to show here. I'm going to illustrate drawdown in the various intervals of this observation well when we pump in this interval of the central well. So drawdown in this interval H of the observation well is which is open to the same fissile mudstone that we're pumping to, is actually fairly subdued, with drawdown occurring late in time and drawdown not very large. In contrast, drawdown in the next interval deeper is much more pronounced than that in the interval open to the same mudstone bed that was pumped. And similarly, even deeper, drawdown is more pronounced. So this is telling us that there is crossbed fracturing that is connecting hydraulically fractures that are down here deeper in other mudstone beds to this mudstone bed being pumped. Similarly, we see as we go shallower in this observation well, a similar type of heterogeneity, where especially these two shallowest intervals have more prominent drawdown responses than the interval in the pumped mudstone bed. Okay, a lot of words on this slide. I'll just briefly cover it. We use modeling to estimate K using all these drawdown data that we've collected. ModFlow is used to simulate the hydraulic tests, and then a geostatistical inversion method is used to estimate K. K is parameterized on a 3D grid covering the volume. The inversion works by minimizing an objective function that consists of two terms, a model fit term, which measures goodness of fit between our observed data and the model equivalence of those data, and a prior information term. We have a very data-rich inversion here, and so because of that, the model fit term dominates. And what I mean by that is it is the main driver of the estimate of the 3D heterogeneity in the K distribution. And the prior term helps fill in parts of the K field that are not as well informed by the drawdown data. So let's look at the estimated hydraulic conductivity. It's shown here via a few slices through the estimated volume, a couple of vertical slices, and an inclined slice that's oriented at the dip and location of that prominent fissile mudstone bed that I discussed. So we see, if we look at the estimate of K within this bed, that we're estimating high hydraulic conductivity in parts of it, but we're also estimating heterogeneity that, for example, is consistent with those drawdown data I showed you, where we didn't have much of a drawdown response at this interval here in the same mudstone bed. So note the huge heterogeneity in K. K varies over 10 orders of magnitude here. Another view of slices through the estimated volume. These slices are stretched out along strike. I want to point out that this approach, where we're estimating K on a 3D grid, we're not estimating discrete fractures with accurate geometry in terms of fracture aperture, for example. We're estimating volumes in which the fractures occur. And so for high permeability fractures, what this shows up in the estimated volume as features with elevated K and fracture-like geometries. And that's illustrated here by this high K that you see persistent along the strike direction at this location, which is indicative of a strike-oriented fracture. I want to show how the estimated K field does a good job of reproducing the complex distribution of drawdown that we saw in the field data that I showed you for this test and, and this well, this observation well. So what I'm going to focus on in showing you that is the order at which drawdown arrives in the different intervals of this observation well. So this is a block, a sub-block of the model showing the drawdown distribution when we pump here. And we're going to see how that drawdown distribution progresses. When we start pumping at 4 seconds elapsed time, we start to see already a heterogeneous distribution of drawdown. First interval at which drawdown reaches our observation well is interval I, which is consistent with the order that it arrived in the data. The next intervals that it arrives at in the model is J and then F, which is opposite the order in the data, but then it arrives in the model at E, G, and H, consistent with the data. And so our model is able to reproduce the fact that at the mudstone, the same mudstone bed that was pumped, drawdown arrives last at that interval in this observation well. Okay, the last result from this work I want to show is identification of the most hydraulically active fracture network. So turning back to remediation, what we're really interested in is something about this K-field that's going to enable us to improve our amendment injection strategy. So this K-field holds within it an estimate of the most hydraulically active fracture network. And we can identify that network by conducting particle tracking through this well field. And we do that to identify the channelized fast particle paths through this K field. And the collective set of model cells that those paths travel through describes this fracture network. Now it's shown here for part of the volume. You see kind of an amorphous set of model cells up here at the top that is in the area of the highly fractured zone. But down here is where it gets more interesting at depth, where this method has identified discrete segments of a fracture network at depth in the well field. It turns out that this fracture network is consistent with interpretation of TCE distribution in rock core samples that were collected throughout this well field. And that interpretation showed that more TCE occurs in the rock matrix in this region of the well field at depth than elsewhere, suggesting the presence of a fracture network that facilitated TCE transport within the fractures than allowing that migration into the rock matrix in this area of the well field. So turning to designing in situ remediation using these results, this estimate of the fracture network helps guide an injection and pumping strategy for spreading amendments to the contaminants. So I came up with an example injection and pumping strategy guided by the presence of this network, and that involved injecting amendments in an interval of one well and pumping in an interval of another well to draw those amendments through the fracture network. This shows the particle paths under that inject and pumping scheme. You can see that the particle paths, the scheme achieves advective transport over the entire discrete network at depth. That's shown by these particle tracks. And to help you see the correspondence, here's some arrows on the particle paths themselves, as well as analogously on the network. Okay, so to summarize this part of the work, this hydraulic tomography method is a robust approach for estimating the high-resolution K distribution, which can lead to improved understanding of flow and transport at a small scale and, in turn, improved remediation design. Is it worth it? I'm sure you've gleaned from this that hydraulic tomography is a very intensive endeavor in the field and also the modeling that's required. So the expense really needs to be weighed in the context of the value that this method can provide to remediation and management. So it's likely to have low value at a less contaminated part of the site where contamination is more dilute. In contrast, it's likely to have a higher value in source zone regions, where if we can get more surgical through HT in our amendment delivery strategies, we can direct amendment to the highest concentration parts of the source zone, reduce concentrations, and therefore reduce the mass flux that's emanating from this source zone down gradient. Okay, final thought. Trying to bring the results of these two different studies kind of together with a few final points. So in these studies, we characterized the subsurface and in particular hydraulic conductivity at different scales. For the bioremediation study, we characterized K on the 10 to 100 meter scale. The K structure was largely imposed, relied a lot on the a priori geologic framework. In contrast, hydraulic tomography at a smaller scale, and we deliberately omitted geologic info to see what we could estimate about the K structure from the hydraulic data alone. But we see consistencies in these results. It may not be super evident just looking at these two figures of results from the two studies, but we saw that the high K along this main fissile bed was estimated in both studies, along with very important heterogeneities, low K regions within this fissile bed were estimated in both studies. I'll skip the next part just for time considerations and move to my final slide, which is that my message from this is that K characterization at both scales is important. At the smaller scale, using hydraulic tomography to estimate high resolution conductivity supports targeted or surgical amendment delivery. And understanding the K distribution at somewhat lower resolution over larger site scale volumes supports then forecasting the downgradient effects and supports of the downgradient effects of contamination emanating from this source zone and supports informing long-term management of contamination. Thank you, and I'd like to acknowledge my many USGS and Boise State colleagues. This was really a team effort that I presented, and all these folks here contributed to the work. And I will leave you with a list of references if you're interested in reading further about any parts of this work. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Claire. I'll give you just a minute to get a breather after that long presentation. And folks, if you want to know more about Claire and the work that she's doing, I'll point you back to our seminar homepage. There's a little more info in Claire's bio there. So Claire has got quite a few questions that came in here. And folks, if you're thinking of things as we go along, please keep typing those into that Q&A pod down in the bottom right. And we'll get to as many of these as possible. So first, Claire, I want to ask you a few questions that were on the bio portion of your presentation. One easy question was someone asked if you used ModFlow for this model.
Yes.
Okay. And I seem to remember USGS does some training on ModFlow too. Is that correct?
Yes, we do. Yes, I'm not always sure how widely that training is available to non-USGS folks, but if anybody is interested in ModFlow training at the USGS, please drop me an email and I can help connect you with that.
Great, thank you. Okay, now let's see. Also in that first portion of the talk, one of the participants noticed that there was an increase in the TCE concentration after 2012. Do you have an interpretation for that?
One thing I'll note, can you remind me, how can I easily get back to that slide?
Yeah, so we can hop. Let's see.
Oh, perfect. Okay, I see. That would be down in the okay. It may be that we've started to see a bit of rebound, but also bear in mind that this is a log scale on the y-axis here, and so that's not actually a huge jump.
Okay. All right, thanks. Let's see, next question. Someone asked, what were your lines of evidence for finding those subsurface press fractures? Can you discuss how you found that?
Yes. If we turn to, well, yes. And I'm not sure how to make the other parts of this slide come up when I show this. Maybe we need to go to full screen and
if you that. Just hit the right arrow, it'll trigger those animations. So try to, there you
okay.
go.
Okay, wonderful. Okay, so when we conducted a shutdown test in this well, meaning that we turned, wrong pointer. When we conducted a shutdown test in 15BR, thank you, and monitored water level rises in all intervals, all packed off intervals shown here, we saw the most prominent water level rises in the intervals shown here in red. So looking at these two wells, we saw a prominent water level rise here in 71BR, but not in the mudstone bed that's in black here. And then in this well, the most prominent water level rise was here, not in any, there was very little water level rise in any of the mudstone beds in this interval. So this suggests that at least hydraulically, the hydraulic connection from say this interval to this interval has to go through crossbed fractures somewhere in here, and the hydraulic connection goes from here along this bed up through crossbed fractures, then through these beds to the pumped well. Hopefully that made sense. We also have evidence, which is unusual, in the acoustic televiewer logs from this well that show evidence of high angle fractures in the vicinity or at this well. It's often hard to see crossbed fracture evidence in acoustic televiewer logs in vertical wells.
Thank you, Claire. Okay. Now, when you were doing your pump tests, what did you do with the pumped water on site? Was there a treatment system that was put into, or did you have to send that off site? Do you remember how that worked out?
Yes, excellent question. A lot of people ask that. Yes, fortunately, at this site, there is a pump and treat system that operates 24/7, so we collected the water and then directed it to that treatment plant. But that's an issue, and what to do with the pumped water in hydraulic tests at contaminated sites. Sometimes if there's not a pump and treat, people will get a giant water tank placed on site to direct that water and then take it off site later for treatment.
Okay, sounds like you lucked out there. let's see. So, okay, hopefully I'll ask this question correctly. I was a little confused reading it. But so why is decreasing TCE concentration in the fractures causing increased diffusion out of the fractures?
Okay, great question. So before we treat the TCE in the fractures, we have a high concentration of TCE in the fractures and probably a high concentration in the matrix. There's not a very large concentration gradient between the matrix and the fractures. That, what drives diffusion is not hydraulic conductivity, but a concentration gradient drives the movement of contamination by diffusion. So when we treat the concentration of TCE in the fractures, we're lowering the concentration in the fractures and creating a much higher concentration gradient that is the driver for that back diffusion. So we sometimes call it, we're mobilizing TCE out of the matrix by virtue of that increased concentration gradient causing increased diffusion rate out of the matrix.
Great, thank you, Claire. Okay, so another participant asked, based on these bioremediation pilot test results, how would you propose improving the full reductive dechlorination?
Yes. I think that studies in the lab by the microbiologists using the microbial consortia that were sampled from this from these intervals where complete reductive dechlorination did not occur, there can be studies done to try to adjust the population of added microbes so that it might be more beneficial to the complete reductive dechlorination, or possibly adjusting the geochemical conditions of the groundwater to have it be more amenable to complete reductive dechlorination. As you can tell, I'm not a microbiologist, so I may not be answering this question in the best manner that my colleagues could, but those are some ideas, is looking carefully at what were the reasons for that lack of complete reductive dechlorination and trying to make adjustments to the microbiology or the geochemistry to improve that situation.
Okay, thank you. Now, another person asked, how did you arrive at that 50 milliliters per minute pump rate?
Good question. In the hydraulic tomography where I came up with that pumping and injection strategy, that is because pumping any higher, although we identified the most hydraulically active fracture network, the permeabilities along that fracture network are not like rip-roaring high. There's still some, you know, moderate conductivities along that network, and therefore it does not support very high injection and pumping rates without, you know, drawing the well that's pumped dry or creating, basically impossible to inject conditions. So I found that those small rates of injection and pumping were achievable in the model without having too large drawdowns or injection pressures build up, and still achieved that advective transport over reasonable time periods over that network, because we're looking at a pretty small region there that advective transport needs to travel over.
Okay, great. Thank you. I've got just a couple more questions for you before we switch over to our other speakers. So I think this one came in during the hydraulic tomography portion of the talk. This participant noted that a muted response in an observation well could be an indication of high K. So how do you determine that the response is associated with a low K zone?
Yes, well, remember that we have multiple hydraulic tests and multiple observation responses that go into the estimate of K. So that's true, what you say, that a muted response can be a high K zone. But if that is a high K zone, then it's likely that some other test we do where it's connected hydraulically, well connected to that pumped interval of the other test, you're going to see a much larger drawdown if it's well connected. So that type of response that complements the more muted one, if it's a high K zone, you're going to see that, and the hydraulic conductivity estimate will need to make it high K to honor all the responses. If it's low K, you would not see that kind of very large response for most of the tests. For most of the tests, no matter where they're done, you would see relatively small responses.
Thank you. Let's see. Then we had another participant ask, did the sandpack sections of your well construction match with the packed off sections during injection? So is it possible that your injections entered other fractured zones than those who were isolated by the packers by traveling vertically through the sandpack?
Okay, we have no sandpack. These are boreholes that are just open to the rock below a cased section through the weathered rocks. So they are just the rock, and the packers are installed and inflated and then act as an impermeable barrier to flow between two adjacent packed off sections. So hopefully that answers the question.
Okay. Great, thank you. So at this point, I think we'll let you off the hook for a bit. We've got a few more questions for you that were kind of more about the overall project and cleanup at this site. If we have time at the end, we'll come back to those. But for now, I want to switch over to our next group of speakers. So thank you, Claire, and hopefully we'll have some time to chat with you a little more at the end here.
Thank you.
So next, I will queue up our following group of speakers. Let's see. So our first speaker is going to be Emerald Laiha, who's with EPA. Jean, I am having, oh, never mind. Sorry, I found it. So while this takes just a second to load up, I will get Emmy going here. So we'll have three speakers on this portion, and I'll just do a quick intro of the three of them. So we'll have Emmy Laiha, who's with EPA. She's an environmental scientist working on Superfund cleanup through the EPA's Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office, or as we know it, CFRO. After Emmy, we will have Kate Amrine. She is a geologist who works for the U.S. Department of Energy in their Richlands operation office. And lastly, we will have Mike Truex, who's with the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. He works in environmental remediation research and field applications. So we will be switching out through these three speakers. Emmy, I think you should be all set here, so I will hand it over to you.
Sure. Thank you so much. Again, everyone, I'm Emmy Laiha with EPA, and the title of our talk is Using Remedy Implementation Information to Guide Remedy Optimization. If there was another or shorter title I could give to our presentation, I would call it Considering Optimization During O&M or Operations and Maintenance. So let's go ahead and look over what we'll be sharing with you today. First, we're going to start off with a site description of our Hanford case study. We'll talk about the conceptual site model and how we went into refining that model. And then we'll switch a bit more into optimization to talk about remedy optimization targets and the optimization study approach that we used and how that meets up with adaptive site management. So now I'm going to hand it over to Kate to tell us a little bit more about the site.
Thank you, Emmy. Good afternoon, everyone. So right here we have a wonderful diagram of the Hanford site, which is located in southeast Washington State. It is approximately 580 square miles, or about 1,500 square kilometers. It is divided into the River Corridor region, which we have our groundwater units right here, up in what we call the Horn region, and then down here. And then we also have our Central Plateau region, which is right here in the center and covers most of these groundwater units right here. And today our focus is going to be right here in this 200 West region. So here out at the Hanford site, we had many different historical processes in plutonium production. And so, as you can see, we have, you know, from manufacturing the fuel elements to irradiating the fuel elements to chemical separations to then actually plutonium production. These last two steps right here were very complex and very messy. And these mostly took place here in the 200 West and 200 East area of the Central Plateau of the Hanford site. So this is where we have the bulk of our contaminants, and we have multiple different types. So in our ZP1 groundwater operable unit, we have carbon tetrachloride, which is our main risk driver out there, and it is a very, very large plume. It was disposed of in three nearby locations to the ZP1 operable unit. And this, with the amount of waste that was discharged, it created this large groundwater mound. And it spread carbon tetrachloride throughout in the groundwater. And it created this 10 square kilometer plume, which was over 50 meters thick. There were early actions taken to remove the continuing source area, which was soil vapor extraction. And it did remove 80,000 kilograms of carbon tetrachloride. And we no longer have a continuing source there now. In our characterization of the carbon tetrachloride, we did not find any dense non-aqueous phase liquids, so no DNAPLs below the water table. And as of today, the groundwater mound now is dissipating since production has ceased. Ever since then, the groundwater has now been lowering to pre-Hanford levels, and the groundwater flow rate is slow in this area. Our groundwater concentrations of carbon tetrachloride are about 1,000 times the remedial action objective, or RAO. We do know that there's some natural attenuation that occurs, but the plume is just so concentrated and so large that MNA, just letting the plume just naturally attenuate itself, is just not feasible. And pump and treat is going to be necessary to help remove the contamination. We also have radionuclide and inorganic co-contaminants present as well within the carbon tetrachloride plume. So here's kind of a graphic that kind of explains what I just talked about, where we have our source area where the waste was discharged, and that area now has been addressed by soil vapor extraction. Here we have our historic groundwater mound from the waste that was disposed, and it was much higher than the natural water table. And we do not have any DNAPLs present right here below the water table. But we also have a very unique feature in this area where we have this ringled lower mud unit that is actually not present in kind of the center of the ZP1 operable unit. And so this creates this window to the lower part of the aquifer where we have observed contamination even lower. And here is another graphic showing how complex this area is. We have the 200 West area right here. We have our 200 East area in this area, in this part of the graphic. And you can see how we have multiple co-contaminants. And right here in the light green is our carbon tetrachloride plume. So it kind of encompasses this area right here. And as you can see, we have chromium present with it. We do have a little bit of iodine, uranium, technetium 99. So there, it's very complex. We don't just have carbon tetrachloride. And so with our remedy selection for our record of decision for the ZP1 operable unit, our RAOs that were put in place restore the aquifer. We know that our source has been now addressed by the soil vapor extraction. We do not have any DNAPL present. We have a large carbon tetrachloride plume with co-contaminants, which makes it very difficult for in-situ remediation. We do know that pump and treat systems can effectively diminish the plumes, but pump and treat alone, we would have difficulty in reaching the RAOs. So if we can diminish the plume enough, remove as much contamination as possible, we can allow natural attenuation to then reach the RAO. And so our remedy that was chosen applies active pump and treat with an eventual transition to monitored natural attenuation. And based on the feasibility study CSM, it was anticipated 25 years of pump and treat and then 100 years of M&A would meet the RAO. There were a few uncertainties, especially with the carbon tetrachloride distribution. We had an uncertainty in the math, which as we collect data during the remedy, we would refine that uncertainty. And then the attenuation rate of carbon tetrachloride was not well known, and it was estimated between 41 and 290 year half-life. And a study was implemented to pin that half-life down a little more. And so now I'm going to pass it off to Mike, who's going to talk about the CSM refinement and our well network that we have out in the 200 West area.
Great. Well, thank you, Kate. So Kate's described the background of our carbon tetrachloride plume. And again, it's a large plume. Described that we're using pump and treat to diminish that plume so that natural attenuation can then be effective in reaching our remedial action objectives. And she also described that we have some uncertainties as we embarked on remediation. You know, we don't know everything at the time that we need to start our remediation. So what I'm going to talk about are some of the things that we've done while remediating to learn more about the plume and our situation to help give us that information to determine any modifications or adaptations that are needed. And that's particularly important because many times you can't do enough characterization to know everything before you start. And remediation itself, in a sense, provides you with additional information. So how do we watch that remediation process in a way that can help us? So I'll start first, though, by giving you an overview of what the pump and treat system looks like in terms of the well configuration. So you can see here is an outline of the overall plume in 2017 at our MCL level. And then this inner level, the lighter green, is the outline at 100 micrograms per liter. And so that's our sort of core of the plume that we're really trying to attack. And the well layout, you see these red triangles, upward pointing triangles, are the extraction wells focused in the center of the plume. And then we surround the center of the plume with our injection. So both at the upgradient and downgradient location to essentially squeeze this plume and begin the process of removing mass. And just for context, our former source area is located here in this location of the red circle. So again, as Kate explained, we don't have a continuing source. We don't have any remaining high concentrations in that area. We're dealing with a dissolved phase plume. So the idea of this initial phase in a treatment is to initiate containment of the plume and mass recovery, and also, like I said, to gain information that will help us adapt and modify the design as needed. So let's talk a little bit about some of the things that we do along the way with Pump and Treat to collect data and help us understand the nature of our plume. So as Kate explained, we have a large plume across a couple different aquifer units. So we do three-dimensional plume mapping and update that with new information annually. So we look at our monitoring well concentrations, we look at extraction and injection well concentrations, and we also, when we install new wells, we collect depth-discrete samples for our contaminants so that we get this depth profiling information that can be added in with our monitoring and extraction and injection well data. So all of that is used to create a 3D plume map and update that as new information is collected. And the key there is we then use that 3D plume map within predictive modeling. And so given our understanding of the 3D plume map, what we can now predict what our expected mass recovery is and our expected concentration profiles are. And then we can compare that to what we see in our data in terms of mass extraction and concentration profile. So that's a way we can kind of test our conceptual site model and make adjustments as we need to and identify where we might need to collect more data or add additional wells. We also, of course, track our progress over time. So this is just a plot showing a change in average and the median and the average, the median, and the upper 95% confidence interval concentrations. And you can see that over time from 2011 on to 2018, we have had a decrease in concentration over time. That's a positive indication. We are removing mass from the aquifer, about 12,000 kilograms, but that's not sufficient to really understand are we on track to meeting our need for diminishing the plume so that we can transition to M&A in our expected time frame. To do that, we really have to add this idea of comparing that rate of decline and the rate of mass extraction to our predictions and using those back and forth as feedback to understand our plume and how our performance is proceeding. The other aspect that we look at carefully is also our hydraulic data with respect to capture of the plume. And so in this way, we collect water level data. We use models to look at capture analysis. We compare that to our plume data. And in this way, we can understand if we have our hands around this plume and where we might need to modify the network. So here you see concentrations on the bottom. We have 1,000 micrograms per liter on down to our remediation target of 3.4 micrograms per liter. And a green bar chart here says that we've captured this 100%. So the 1,000 microgram per liter plume has been captured 100%. The core of the plume, which we've identified as sort of this 100 microgram per liter level, we at this point in time had captured to about 90%. And if you remember back in that, in our plume map, we had this sort of thumb, what we call the thumb area up top. And that was an area that we had discovered when we were looking at our water level capture zone data and our plume data, and that is this portion that we see in red here, where we have not done, had not done full capture at this point. So this is information we look at, and then we modify the extraction and injection well network so that we are moving towards having full capture at this level. Now, we also capture out to further plume shells, so to speak, although with a diminishing capture. And again, the goal of this pump and treat system is not to capture and remove all the mass. It's to remove enough mass so that M&A can then proceed to reach our RAOs. So what we do is we try and manage this. And at this point, we're managing in this 50 to 100 microgram per liter zone in order to try and capture and remove mass. So that's another way we look at the plume in order to examine how we're performing over time and compare that to what our model predictions are. And so it's important that we have sort of a structured approach to what I've talked about. So I've given you a couple examples, but in our performance and monitoring plan, we lay this out in some fair detail because, again, there are a lot of moving parts to this plume, like Kate explained. And so we did a DQO process. We identified decision statements and selected specific types of monitoring that we're going to do all the time within our plume. But just monitoring and collecting data is not enough. We need to calculate certain things. And so I've talked to you about how we calculated capture zones and done 3D plumes and looked at our mass extraction from an aquifer level. We also do that at individual wells. In other words, we have to take that data and interpret it in terms of performance metrics. But then importantly, we have to compare that to prediction. And in that way, we can say, are the changes that are occurring that we observe commensurate with what we think should be happening? And if they are not, what sort of adjustments do we need to make? And so that's the portion that we talk about under our reporting. So we have a series of different types of interpretations that we make every year to look at this performance, interpret what it means to us, and from that then determine if we have to optimize or make adjustments in our approach for pump and treat. And so this might include how we might adjust pumping rates at different wells or how we might change our well network. That's how we look at this every year in terms of this series of actions. And what we're aiming at is to understand how that plume is changing and when can we reach a point when we can transition from pump and treat to monitor natural attenuation. Now, of course, we'll have to confirm that with things like rebound studies, but we're trying to manage this overall plume to say, hey, are we on track to run our pump and treat for the time frame we were intending and then transition to M&A for those RAOs? And that sort of bigger scale question is important to keep in mind because while we need to look at sort of the individual details about portions of the plume where we might need to adjust pumping, we also have to keep this big picture in mind of hey, are we on track in total in terms of reaching our remedial action objectives. And so now I'm going to transition over to Emmy, and she'll kind of talk to you about some of the things that we've learned during our performance assessment over time, and then how we're now taking action with respect to those larger scale remedial action objectives. So Emmy, here you go.
Thanks, Mike. So as Mike mentioned, we've collected a lot of data, and through that process, we identified some challenges. So with the carbon tetrachloride, we realized that there was much more carbon tetrachloride in the lower part of the aquifer than we had identified during the feasibility study. So we had originally estimated about 12%, but it's actually more like 25%. And part of that is because we now better understand right here where this the mud unit doesn't exist. Kate referenced it as a window. When we were doing the FS and conducting our characterization, we did not want to punch wells through that mud unit because we were concerned that we would be introducing pathways for carbon tetrachloride to move deeper into the aquifer. At that time, because we were so careful in how we were doing characterization, we didn't fully understand just the size of this window and how much carbon tetrachloride had already made its way to the lower part of the aquifer. So now that's better understood with the data we have, but more characterization is planned to really identify the extent of contaminants of concern in the Ringgold A unit as well as its hydraulic properties. So that was one challenge that we identified. I'll go to the next slide here and continue talking about challenges with carbon tetrachloride, and that dealt with the abiotic degradation rate. In the feasibility study, we had projected about a 41-year to 290-year half-life for that degradation to occur. That was based on a higher temperature. It was extrapolated from other studies, not site-specific information. Now that we have site-specific temperature and have 6 years of data, we know that instead of 41 years, we're looking at something more like 630 years for degradation to happen. So in this chart, you can see the very significant difference we have when you're dealing with 41 years, where that relative concentration decreases at a fairly steady rate over the 100-year M&A time frame period versus 630 years, which the decrease in that concentration is much, much slower. So that's another challenge that we're looking at. The team is also looking at studying other degradation mechanisms that might be taking place at the site, but just based on this alone, we know what we were considering from M&A will probably have to be revisited. So what all have we taken from this information to date? Well, we know that we need to really focus on more intensive mass removal during the pump and treat period to ensure that we will be able to transition to M&A. Recall, as part of our design, we estimated we would pump and treat for 25 years and then have an M&A period of 100 years after that. We may need to consider more time for M&A. That's something that's on the table. And we know we need more information in that lower unit in the aquifer for Ringgold A to be able to best assess what approach should be used. So I spent quite a bit of time talking about carbon tetrachloride, but I'd like to switch gears to nitrate now and some considerations we had around that contaminant. So if you recall the plume map, carbon tetrachloride was the largest plume, but overlaid or co-located with that was a pretty good-sized nitrate plume as well. And that was a result of the massive amounts of nitric acid that were used during operations in the central part of the Hanford site. So I'll have some graphics to clarify the point I'm going to make on here. But just to start, we are considering whether sufficient nitrate may have already been removed from the Ringgold E part of the aquifer, the more shallow part, to allow us to stop that active biological treatment component of our pump and treat system, and for nitrate alone be able to transition to M&A in step with what is identified in the record of decision. We already know it through extracting this contaminated groundwater, there's going to be some blending that happens as that water is taken to the pump and treat system. We know and really have a good sense of the natural attenuation that will occur after reinjection. But in the system itself, if we were able to consider suspending biological treatment, and again, I'll have a graphic in a second, that might allow us to better focus on carbon tetrachloride treatment and the capacities there. And it could also help us with some operational difficulties we had with biofouling of the wells that was based on byproducts from this biological treatment component. So now let's get to the graphics to help illustrate what I'm trying to say. So in this graph here, we're looking at the contaminants of concern mass removed for 6 years, 2012 to 2018. And you can see for nitrate, we have removed a significant mass of nitrate contamination. Carbon tetrachloride is where we really want to focus our efforts. We've done great work for removing carbon tetrachloride to date, but there's just so much effort or so much energy going into the nitrate removal because of those very high concentrations that we're dealing with in the aquifer. On this next slide, we're looking at a very simplified representation of the sophisticated pump and treat system that we have. So here, one thing I want to point out that about 40% of our operations and maintenance costs is due to nitrate treatment. So looking at the simplified representation here, we have our extraction wells. The water gets pumped out of the aquifer. Then, as appropriate, water with uranium contamination gets sent to a uranium ion exchange. Water with, technetium-99 gets sent to that train accordingly, and then all other water that doesn't have radionuclide contamination would go to these fluidized bed reactors, and this is where the nitrate treatment occurs. And this is actually the pinch point in the system that was limiting flow because there was so much nitrate that had to be removed. After this step in the process, water is sent for removal of carbon tetrachloride through air strippers, and then the vapor is sent through GAC units, and the effluent would be re-injected, as Mike mentioned, into the perimeter of the plume to help force that groundwater flow back to the extraction wells. So knowing that we have a pinch point here in the FBRs, the fluidized bed reactors, and that a significant amount of our O&M costs are coming from this effort, not to mention the impact on our ability to reinject water because of biofouling associated with byproducts from the FBRs, we thought, well, what can we do with all of these challenges that are on the table? So going to the next slide. Just one second. I got a message. My connectivity was lost, but if someone can confirm for me that you're still seeing the slides, I can continue speaking to them.
Hey, Emmy, this is Jean. We can still see your slides, and when that connection comes back, you can take over, but in the meantime, we can advance for you.
Okay, perfect, thanks. So on slide 20, I was just switching gears there. We were talking about the flow through the system and where the pinch points were. So taking all of that information and looking at the challenges, could we potentially turn off the nitrate treatment component that would allow us to send more of that extracted water to the air strippers where carbon tetrachloride treatment occurs? So I'll have more on that in just a second. But going to slide 20 for the optimization study rationale, we had 6 years of data to look at the 200 West Pump and Treat system. So looking at the current remedy as designed and projecting it forward, we were already able to note it looks like we're not going to be able to meet our remedial action objectives because we have a larger mass of carbon tetrachloride in the aquifer, and we're dealing with that slower degradation rate. Also, because we understand that carbon tetrachloride is our most significant risk driver, being at almost to 1,000 times greater than our remedial action objective, is there a way to focus on that contaminant and make the best use of our treatment system to reduce the risk? So we look to optimization as a way to make opportunities out of these challenges. So I think I'm back online. We'll go to the next slide. There we go. So again, how do we make opportunities out of this bag of lemons, so to speak? So we looked at an optimization study plan. If we could suspend biological treatment, at least for a specified amount of time, and then look to see how that affects contaminant behavior in the aquifer, knowing it's going to help with our ability to reinject water because we'll have less biofouling, let's look at that. What about the treatment capacity for carbon tetrachloride? If we can increase that capacity by adding an additional air stripper, we can also see what impacts that would have on our mass removal. The thing to keep in mind here, and something Mike was very good about pointing out with the graphic he shared, is that it's intended to be an iterative process. It's not a one and done. It's a continuous evaluation of data and decision making to make sure we're proceeding forward and reducing the uncertainties as much as possible by having a regular look at the data and adjusting accordingly. So once sufficient data is collected and evaluated, the site team, along with the regulators, will work together to determine if the remedy needs to be changed. Is 100 years from M&A still an appropriate amount of time? Is 25 years for pump and treat still going to work? We'll look back and consider if those REOs need to be changed or if the time frames listed are still reasonable. One thing I will say, the site team did agree that we're not trying to change cleanup level to a less conservative cleanup. That's really not on the table right now. But once we have enough information to look at our REOs, it makes sense to have that conversation. And I think one thing we haven't really hit with this group yet today is just saying that across all the different parties involved. We had DOE, EPA as the regulator, contractors, PNNL. It was really a team effort to look at the challenges that were presented in implementing this remedy and thinking outside of the box, but within the remedy identified in the ROD, to see how we could move forward to continue progress with at the site and specifically for this groundwater treatment. All right, so going on to the next slide, I just want to take a minute to talk a little bit about how EPA supports optimization. So back in 2012, EPA released a national strategy that talked about implementing optimization practices throughout all phases of the remedial process. And it really is looking at opportunities to improve protectiveness, effectiveness, and cost efficiency. You know, anywhere we can save costs and still maintain our level of protectiveness is a good thing. And of course, anything that facilitates progress toward completion of site work is also supported. As far as how optimization lends itself to adaptive management, I will say EPA has had more of a recent effort to focus on adaptive management and having it implemented across site cleanup. So this graphic here is taken from a July 2018 memo, and it really shows how adaptive management, which optimization can be a part of, can be implemented during your RISS, during your remedial design and remedial action efforts, and during O&M. So that continuous reevaluation and management of site priorities is important. Having a structured and continuous planning and decision-making process is also important because it can help you reduce those site uncertainties. For example, with us, that deeper part of the aquifer where we know we need to do more characterization, it allows us to step forward with the collection of the appropriate data so that we're in a better position to make the decisions needed for that site. So here on our last slide, we have a very beautiful picture, I believe, at sunset of our 200 West Pump and Treat facility. So I'll go ahead and pause for a second and see if there's any questions for the group.
Thank you, Emmy. We have had loads of questions coming in, so I'll keep you guys busy for a minute here. So first off, let's see. Let me go back to Mike for a minute. Start with some questions there. So Mike, can you talk a little bit about how the time frame to reach restoration was determined, and if any of these questions are also well answered by the other speakers, feel free to volley them over.
I can talk to that. So in the feasibility study, of course, there were predictive models done based on the remedial alternatives that identified the expected performance of those alternatives. And so the pump and treat and M&A remedy alternative design looked at both the time frame for diminishing the plume and then that M&A portion, and then that overall time frame was selected based on the ability to reach the targets, which in our case is 3.4 micrograms per liter, and also that those would be reached within, keeping the carbon tetrachloride within a specific portion of the aquifer, right? So the time frame is related to both the pump and treat removal effectiveness, the M&A degradation rate, and of course the migration rate, and the balance of the degradation and the migration rate are what have to be looked at in terms of both the time frame to reach the concentration and to make sure that the plume does not migrate to areas where it's not wanted. So it's basically a modeling exercise to determine that time frame. And I will point out that of course was based on the information available at the time, which as Emmy and Kate and I have tried to explain, you know, we've learned new things over time that we'll need to now go back and reevaluate that overall performance. But that's part of what the optimization study will allow us to do is collect some good information that will help us with reevaluating that overall remedy performance and time frame.
Thank you, Mike. I'll take this related question to Emmy. So if we're assuming a transition to M&A at 25 years, what carbon tetrachloride concentration are you expecting to have when you transition to M&A?
Mike, correct me if I'm wrong. I believe that 3.4 micrograms per liter for carbon tetrachloride was the concentration we thought at this point we can allow the rest of the carbon tetrachloride to be addressed through M&A.
Slight correction. So 3.4 is our target. 100 was our transition point based on the original estimate of the abiotic hydrolysis rate. So that's why when you saw that initial well layout and when we showed that 100 microgram per liter contour, that was the target. We needed to get all our concentrations down to that level or lower, and then at the original understanding of the degradation rate, we would be able to reach the 3.4 within our time frame. We now have to look at that in terms of both the target. We may have to go to a lower target now with pump and treat based on what our current degradation rate is. So yes, thanks for pulling that plot back up. So you can see here this internal 100 microgram per liter is what our initial target was for pump and treat to essentially get down to that level or lower everywhere within the plume before natural attenuation.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you both. So I think that Emmy touched on this a little bit, but this question came in a little earlier. So can you talk about whether a performance assessment approach was developed as part of the initial remedial design? And was adaptive management specifically identified in your design approach?
I'll start with the adaptive management question. So in the record of decision and the RDROA work plan, we did not specifically call out adaptive management in that term, but we did have language saying, oh, as the wells are installed and data becomes available, we will look at that information. So it wasn't clearly stated in black and white, but the implication was that we would look, as we knew we would learn from installing wells and getting all that additional data, that we'd be able to adjust accordingly.
Yeah, and I'll just add briefly to that. So at Hanford, we you know, sort of a standard practice implement remedial process optimization approaches, and so that's consistent with what Emmy described. You know, we didn't have at that point back in 2012 specifically an adaptive portion of the plan. We did have elements like I showed you for a performance monitoring plan in terms of identifying key metrics to look at to feed that optimization process. We have modified that over time as we both learned in about the plume, but also learned about management of the plume over time. So we've been updating our documents to help us sharpen the pencil, so to speak, in how we look at the plumes. But we've now come to the point where we've made these decisions to use the optimization study, and that has led us to more sort of congruence with this broader concept of adaptive site management.
Thank you. This question came in for, I think this one was for Emmy. So was reductive dechlorination considered for carbon tetrachloride?
I'm actually going to see if Mike can answer that question.
Yes, the answer is yes. We did look at in situ remediation, including bioremediation. In fact, there was a field treatability test of in situ bioremediation for carbon tetrachloride. So yes, there were in situ remedies in the FS. The difficulty is applying those at this extremely large scale, and also some of the performance elements with respect to distributing amendments and those sorts of things. So because we were in a position where pump and treat was viewed as a way that we could diminish the plume within a discrete period of time, and we could apply, there were natural attenuation mechanisms available to us. Pump and treat was selected as a remedy in that FS.
Thank you. Okay, I'm kind of hopping around here. Still got a handful of questions. So if there was, let's see, nitrate from the former use of nitric acid, what kind of pH was the groundwater that you were extracting?
So I go ahead and answer that. At the Hanford site, there was nitric acid used. Those were used in processes, though, and typically they did some degree of pH neutralization based on the concoctions they were using prior to discharge. So we're not always discharging low pH. Only at certain sites did they do that. There's also a lot of carbonate buffering that occurs at the discharge sites. We have a very thick vadosone in the Central Plateau, about 80 meters thick, and so that's a lot of distance to move, and a lot of carbonate buffering occurs in that zone. So really the pH of the aquifer is 7.7 to 8, a typical carbonate buffered system pH. So we don't see any real effects of that, other than historically there were some localized zones, but those have since pretty much been buffered back to near normal pH.
Thank you. Now, Mike, I think this question came in for you, and you may have touched on this a little bit, but can you talk about how the total mass was calculated?
Well, that's a three-dimensional plume analysis with Krigging routines. There are assumptions made, of course, related to not having any source material, which have been backed up and validated by our subsequent characterization. We did an extensive characterization near the source area for DNAPL in the groundwater, didn't find any, so we could back that up and just look at dissolved plume. And then also based on not having continuing source from our SD performance and demonstrating through our assessment that there was no continuing source there. So essentially it's a three-dimensional Krigging sort of routine that's used to then develop mass estimates along with that, and obviously including both the dissolve phase and our estimate for the partitioning to the solid phase for carbon tetrachloride.
Thank you, Mike. So I've got a question that came in for Emmy. How do you reconcile completing treatment in a reasonable amount of time with the long projected time that's needed to achieve the RAOs?
So if I understand the question correctly, we're looking at a time frame at least of 125 years for this remedy to be implemented. So I think the question was, how do you balance that long time frame with being able to achieve REOs, particularly when we have new data that suggests we might need more time? So I think it's always important to look at the latest information and consider it, because our understanding, like the CSM, evolves over time, and that's a good thing because we better understand what's happening, especially in the deeper parts of the aquifer for this site. So I think it's always important to look at the data, look at things like the degradation rates. There is, like, technically speaking, we're going to be able to calculate how long that will take, and maybe there's ways to make it go faster. Maybe we could pump and treat longer, or pump and treat more pointedly or in more targeted areas. That's some of the things that we're considering to really try and stay within that original time frame of 25 years of pump and treat with 100 years of M&A. But it really is looking at new data and adjusting as you need to adjust. Did Kate or Mike, did you want to add to that?
No, I think that's a fair explanation.
Thanks, Emmy. So another question that came in was, when do you decide that adaptive management is no longer providing value, or in other words, reaching diminishing returns?
So with adaptive management, this is Emmy, I see that as it's a process for decision making, that continuous evaluation of data to allow you to be able to adapt and make decisions closer to real time versus a one and done or once every few years. So as far as the approach of adaptive management itself, I'm not sure when you would have diminishing returns. If that question is geared more towards when would we be willing to change the remedy, based on what we're seeing as far as the impacts of doing pump and treat and allowing for M&A, then I think that question's a little different, but adaptive management as an approach can help you make the best informed decision in answering that question.
Thank you.
I'll just add
Go ahead.
Sorry, just a little bit to add to that. And, you know, I think the adaptive management has been extremely useful in terms of this idea of getting feedback and looking at how we can make modifications and collect data during this active phase. Once we get to where we transition to M&A and we sort of get on that glide path, then the sort of the pace of adaptations and looking at data might change. And we may, you know, hopefully at that point we don't have to do any more adaptations. We'll be on the right glide path. But I think as a process, you know, it doesn't really ever go stale because we always want to be looking at data and evaluating it, the performance of that we're observing compared to the performance that we want to obtain, and using that process to help us support decisions. So that's all I can add for some additional perspective.
Thank you both. We just had another question that was kind of related. You may have touched on some of this already, but what considerations, if any, would have caused you to abandon the chosen remedial approach?
So our remedial approach is pump and treat, followed by, oh, Mike, do you want to jump in on this?
No, go ahead, Amy.
Okay. So we are having a lot of success with the pump and treat approach. So given that, it's not, if we had zero success or we couldn't pump anything out of the aquifer, or if we had contaminants that behaved differently and didn't allow, you know, weren't conducive to pump and treat, then that would make sense to consider a different approach if pump and treat is not working. For us, pump and treat is working very well. It's just that we have more mass than we originally anticipated, and the carbon tetrachloride is not degrading as quickly as we originally thought it would. So with the success we've seen to date, that, you know, keeps us within the remedy identified in the record of decision. I think to abandon an approach is if you're having just insurmountable challenges and little to no success in its implementation, or maybe you get new information that really changes your CSM. Only in something like that do I think you would have to really reconsider the remedial approach.
Thank you. Okay, I've got a couple more questions in here. Let's see if I can dig these up. The folks are very curious about cost of this scale of a site and this kind of remedy. Mike, do you have any comments that you want to make on cost at this site?
Well, the cost in the rod was on the order of, I think, about $250 to $300 million. And so it's an expensive remedy. It's a very large plume. It's hundreds of millions of dollars. It is for carbon tetrachloride and many other constituents, which Kate described in terms of the other radionuclides that we're dealing with. But yes, this is an expensive remedy, and therefore it's very important for us to really be diligent in trying to make it as efficient and effective as possible, especially during this pump and treat period, during the active remediation. So that's why we're applying these techniques to refine our approach, because again, no matter what we do, it's going to be expensive. So let's try and minimize that overall expense. So that gives you at least some broad perspective on the types of costs and efforts we're dealing with.
Thank you. And maybe Emmy knows off the top of her head, you know about what it costs to operate the pump and treat each year?
Oh, off the top of my head, I don't. We often reference that 40% savings by pausing nitrate treatment, but I don't have the number off the top of my head. It is high. I can definitely say that much. But I, you know, one thing I'll say, though, for this remedy, the 200 West Pump and Treat facility was identified as part of the remedy for this ZP1 groundwater operable unit. But we looked for more efficiencies in using the facility for other groundwater operable units at the Hanford site so we can make sure that we're really making the best use of the facility as we move forward.
Thank you, Emmy. So I think at this point we have exhausted our questions for the second group. In the interest of time, I think we're going to go ahead and wrap this up. But I want to thank our speakers again. Thank you, Emmy, Kate, and Mike for this presentation. And thank you, Claire, for our earlier presentation. Let me just come over back to our information on this session. I just want to point out that there will be an upcoming FRTR meeting where we'll see some info on bioremediation. So if you enjoyed today's session, I want to make sure that you remember to go to frtr.gov, check out the info for more FRTR webinars and meetings there. And lastly, I will hand it over to Jean to remind you how to get credit for attending today's webinar.
All right. Thank you so very much, Cindy. I want to echo your thanks and just close out with a few quick reminders. So if you're interested in replaying previously recorded versions of events that were hosted on CLUIN as part of this ongoing FRTR Presents webinar series, you can visit us at CLUIN, and we've put a screenshot here. If you look under Training and Events, there's a tab that'll pop out for archived internet seminars. You can search through that archive and simply enter in FRTR Presents, and that should bring in a whole long list of previously hosted sessions. One of the other things that I wanted to point out is that you can sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. It goes out on the first of each month, so we sent it out just this morning. And if you'd like to learn about future events, webinars, as well as other sessions, perhaps in-person ones when we're all able to get back together, I encourage you to sign up for that free newsletter. We will announce resources, online training, as well as documents, and then, again, in-person trainings when they are available in there. So again, I encourage you to connect with us or visit us at CLUIN whenever you can. Copies of the presentation materials have already been posted on the seminar homepage, so if you visit the links on the right side under related URLs, you'll find a link to something called the Seminar Resources. You can click it once to select it and then press that Browse To button to open it up on your own computer. You'll also find contact information for our presenters and organizers on that page. I'd ask each of you to fill out a brief online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's session. And please know I do read each and every one of your submissions, and we do count on your feedback to help to continue online sessions like today's broadcast. So if you're looking for a certificate, while I can't issue PDHs or CEUs, we can provide you with a participation certificate that may help you document your attendance with your own accrediting institution. When you fill out that online feedback form, each of you will have an opportunity to check a box at the bottom of the form. And as long as you check that box certifying you were here for the whole thing or replayed the whole recorded version, as long as you enter your email address and submit the form in, you'll immediately have access to a certificate that will have your name, the length of the session, and other details on the event. And you can save that for your own records or print it out. If for some reason there were others with you at your location attending today's session, they can also fill out that online feedback form, even though they may not have registered individually. Simply share the link to the feedback form with them, and then again, they complete it on their own to get their own certificate. And for you replaying the recorded version, those links will still work on the right side, so you can still follow the links to the seminar feedback form and fill that out to get a certificate based off of your replay of the archived version. So when that recording is available, it usually takes us about 1 week to make it available. You'll automatically receive an email with instructions on how to replay and provide feedback. So with that, I appreciate everyone's participation today. We had a great turnout, over 230 people connected for our live session today. I also want to thank Cindy and our presenters.